You want to know why you're all fucked up?
What is nothing?
Yeah, that's deep.
What in the fuck are we doing here?
What is something?
That's deep, bro. Welcome to That's Deep, Bro. Oh, that was abrupt and terrible. Sorry. I'm your host, Christina P. Thank you for downloading this episode of That's Deep, Bro. Let's get to some business. Firstly, thank you everybody in San Francisco that came out to see me perform at Cobb's this last Sunday. It was amazing. It was so much fun. I really appreciate it. And let's keep the comedy train moving. May 4th is sold out in Huntington Beach. May 5th, however, has been added to the Rec Room. Tickets are still available for that. That is this Saturday. So snap them up. And then May 9th, Oxnard at Levity Live. And then November 24th, House of Blues in San Diego, California. Those tickets are now on sale to the general public. December 8th, New York City Gramercy Theater. A theater. Tickets are available at Christina P. Online. And what else? I don't know. I that's it. Okay. So I normally start the show with music, but I opened up my computer and this was up and I felt like it was very serendipitous. It is the fabulous Bill Hicks. This is probably one of my favorite bits of his that he ever did. He's dead. He died at like 34 of cancer, which is crazy. But spent the last, his remaining time on Earth touring, of all things. But he's a legend. I love him. And I hope you enjoy Bill Hicks and this episode.
Well, I tell you something. I learned something very important watching that Clarence Thomas hearing. Do you know what I learned? I don't stand a fucking chance. Don't even call the committee to order. It'd be a real short hearing. Mr. Hicks, are you familiar at all with a video series called Clam Lappers, Volumes 1 through 90? All of them? I don't recall. Mr. Hicks, are you familiar at all with a man named Manuel who works at the Show World Adult Video Parlor? Manny! Mr. Hicks, they subpoena me. But I tell you, after the Pee Wee Herman thing and then after the Clarence Thomas hearings, pornography's gotten a really bad name in our country. And I'd like to state for the record right now, I love pornography. Love it. I have tapes that are pure fucking art, I'm telling you. People fucking sucking every imaginable position, the finest looking women fucking sucking. I love it. For the record. Well, Mr. Hicks, thank you for your testimony. I don't know if we have a place for you right now on the Supreme Court. But boy, you ever thought about becoming a senator? Come here, boy. Bring some of them tapes over here. Look at that. Whoa. Bring them over to Teddy's house. Yeah, look at that there. Woo, she go to that like a duck to water. Look at that there. How, how, how.
There you go. Bill Hicks, guys, if you don't know who this person is, and you love stand-up comedy as I do, go ahead and check him out. He's probably, arguably, I think one of the greats. I know a lot of us comics look up to Bill Hicks. He was just the OG gangster of, he's intelligent. He's thought provoking. He hated the apathy of a lazy American anti-intellectualism. And he was a really skilled joke writer. You heard that little bit right there, pretty fucking skilled and also a tremendous performer. It's very rare that you get all of those things in one human being. And he's got kind of the legend, the lore of he died early. He died at 34 of cancer and basically toured up until his death, which is bonkers. I mean, personally, if I'm on my deathbed, I'm not sure. I'm not sure the Chuckle Hut in whatever city is the place I'd like to be spending my last few days. But so he's got this kind of a wonderful mythology in the comic world as being like one of the greats. And he really was. He was so, so smart. And again, I think too, you know, he's saying stuff that even like today, I think people would go, whoa, that's pretty crazy. Like how out there. And that was recorded in 1992, guys. And it's shocking still by 2018 standards, which is fucking pathetic and kind of scary. But yeah, but I think Hicks was responding to the kind of Reagan or George Bush, first Bush regimes and, you know, speaking his mind and stuff. So, yeah, Bill Hicks, one of the best. Also, Carlin, hello. Also, fucking amaze. Much needed today. Much needed. Okay, so let's go on. I feel like this is a weird episode. I just feel a little, I'm feeling like breaking the mold a little today. Well, first I exercised and I don't look good when I exercise. I'm not one of these people who I'm not really proud of it. And I sense in the culture today, like you have to not only exercise, but you have to prove that you've exercised. You have to display the exercise on Instagram. Because if you haven't Instagrammed your fitness, you haven't done it. And I can't think, and every time I see people doing it, like posting workout videos of themselves or like, I worked out, guys. And I get it. You want the accolades, right? You want the back slaps. You want people to be stoked for you that you did it. Like you overcame the inertia that is, you know, should I work out? Oh God, I don't know. Which is why I have a trainer. I fucking book a woman who holds me accountable and I show up and I have to. I have to because I paid for it. But the thought of her, I guess, holding the camera to me as I'm disgustingly, you know, doing these exercises. I look terrible when I do them. I'm not athletic to begin with. And the thought of me bragging about it on social media, it's like, it's the most revolting thought I could have. And it probably just because I don't look good. Like I don't look like Kate Hudson when I do Pilates, you know. I don't look like any, like there's some people who really belong in the exercising video, but it's not for me. I wish maybe I should start posting just to show you guys how I do it despite being terrible at it. I'm fucking terrible at it. Anyways, I keep at it. I keep wanting to do it. I need to do it. Otherwise, I don't feel great. So I did it. And then I was thinking about this week about this idea of closure and about the idea of forgiveness, which is a really big theme in the self-help therapy, whatever world of trying to get your life right. There's always the theme of forgiving that person that did something terrible to you. And because ultimately you're just holding that anger inside of yourself. And isn't it better to not be angry and to transcend all that stuff and be the bigger person and forgive and let go and let go. That's another big one. And I mean, it's really hard to do that. It's really, really hard, especially if you are in therapy and you are kind of examining different relationships you've had in the past or are having, whatever the heck. And it is, and let's put it this way. There are some people who don't deserve your forgiveness. What about that? What about child molesters? What about people that have raped? What about, you know, the real physical abusive pieces of shit that hurt children and, you know, not just your run of the mill, like shitty parent, but like the real deal, like scum fucks. If I were molested by somebody, I probably wouldn't. I don't know if I would ever get to forgiveness. It might take an entire lifetime to get to forgiveness, or locked in a closet or whatever. And I don't know. I've just been thinking about it, and I think the nature of it, our culture tends to want us to get to the light side of the force very quickly, right? Like, you got to move on. There's always this talk. People always tell you, you got to move on. You got to have closure. You got to, and it's like it, the mind and the emotions kind of don't work that way. I think that tendency to want to forgive and move on and all that stuff kind of cuts out the middleman. It cuts out the ugly shit that you have to do to get to forgiveness. The excruciatingly depressing work of like really feeling your feelings and really going through something. You know what I'm saying? Like allowing yourself to really sit and marinate in the awfulness of the trauma, of the thing, of the person, of the situation that you're trying to, quote, forgive or get over or whatever that is. Because as humans, like, who wants to feel shitty? Who wants to feel badly about themselves? Who wants to be depressed? Who wants to be... Nobody. And so I get these emails about, like, well, I just broke up with someone or this horrible thing happened. How do I just get to feeling normal again? How do I just feel good again? And it's like, well, I mean, fuck, I mean, there's entire industries built around that, the solution is in makeup, right? You ever go, and I mean, I'm hooked on buying makeup lately because I look like hot shit warmed over. And I swear every time I buy anything of makeup, I'm like, this is it. This is the concealer that's going to change my life. This is it. I'm going to buy this thing and like everything's going to change. It's going to turn everything around for me. And then you realize like, oh, that's not really the answer. But yeah. But that's what everyone wants to sell you on, right? The makeup, the diets, the clothes, the cars, the whatever the fuck it is that's going to take away the need for you to actually feel like shit for a prolonged amount of time. And then after which you do come out okay, right? Because I will tell you this thing I learned is that with forgiveness and closure and all this horseshit and confronting people I was talking to my shrink about it, and apparently you need that other person to take responsibility for what they've done to you. So you'd have to be dealing with somebody who is really able to go, oh, I did that to you. I didn't realize it hurt you so badly. I'm so sorry. I'm going to take responsibility and gosh, let's heal this, you know? And if you have one of those people in your life who's done something and you can kind of make amends, you have to be on the same, you have to share a reality in order to do that. And if that's the case, then great. There is such a thing as forgiveness and closure and moving on. But that person has to acknowledge what they've done and how they've wronged you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, in the case of you know, hey, dead people or people that are on another planet mentally, we all deal with those. There is no such thing as closure, as true closure, as true forgiveness. And yeah, and that's complicated and that sucks. And that's one of those things that I think just over time, you kind of, you accept more and more and more, but I don't think you completely get over and forgive. I think that that's not, I don't know. Is that entirely accurate? I just think you get used to something more and more, and it's less of a thing in your consciousness. It's less of a bite. It's less of a blaming thing. There's less charge to that thought. And I don't know, maybe over time, yeah, you do, but you forgive, I don't know. Anyways, I will say this, that in my mother's death, and she and I had a very complicated relationship, that I've grown much more fond of her and more empathetic towards her plight and her being mentally ill and all this stuff. And I forgive that, I guess, is what you would say. Like, you go like, well, I forgive that situation. I forgive the scenario that she was in and all that stuff. And ironically, I do think she actually did do the best that she could, because she did try to read self-help books. Like, she had an entire collection, ironically, of all these self-help books. And I think she tried to kind of improve on herself the best that she could. But yeah, alas, there are really a lot of limitations there. A lot of limitations. But anyways, that's kind of my thought this week about forgiveness and closure. And I think it kind of ties in nicely to some of these emails that have come in. Hold on. Let me find the one that it ties into. Okay, I found it. This email comes from a girl named Autumn. She says, I was listening to That's Deep Bro episode 162, and you were talking about your mom passing away and the struggles that came with it. You also mentioned not being in contact with her for 8 years and it not being a reality for most people to patch things up with their parents who have been shit on their whole lives. This really got me thinking. I just got my mom back in my life for over a year now, and things have been better than I imagined. She calls me, makes me dinner, listens to what's on my mind. We go to lunch and shop, and is an active participant in my life now. Even though I'm not used to having a mom around, the little girl inside is just beaming with excitement. With that being said, there's some backstory. I'm 29 years old. I grew up with a very self-absorbed, TBH, narcissistic, drug-addicted mother. What's TBH, narcissistic? Textbook? I grew up pretty much taking care of her. I've lived off and on with my grandparents, who are both now passed on, mostly because my mom has been in trouble with the law multiple times. She went to prison for the first time when I was 15, and thank goodness my 26-year-old sister, who happened to be living with us, took care of me and my little brother, who was only 7 at the time. Oof. Since then, she's been to prison 3 times. After the second time, my sister moved away and my brother and I went up to live with our grandma. Shortly after that, our grandmother passed away. My uncle told us right before she passed, we wouldn't be on the streets and we could live there, but sold a house and told us we had 8 days to find somewhere to live. I went to court, got custody of my brother, did the best I could trying to raise a young boy only 8 years younger than me. Yikes. Making things work, my mom got out and wanted my brother back. But I didn't think that was healthy, so I kept and let her visit. My brother resented me for it. Shortly after being home, our mom went right back in. Ooh, fast forward to today. My mom is back in mine and my siblings' lives, and things have been going smoothly. I'm still skeptical every day that she will be ripped away from us again, and sometimes get anxiety just thinking about her leaving us again. I keep reminding myself that my mom has been clean and sober for 7.5 years now, but only 1.5 of those may have been by choice. The others may be because she was locked up. I actually do enjoy getting to know her, but maybe that could make it worse later. Am I making the right choice by giving her another chance just because she's clean, or would it have been smart to protect myself for the what if? Thanks a bunch, Autumn. Oh my goodness, Autumn. What a story, huh? Holy mackerel. So you're asking if it's right to give her another chance, or just protect yourself for what if, for the inevitable. She's been clean for 7.5 years. That's cool. Even though 1.5 of those are by choice. Now, from what I understand, though, in prison, drugs are still pretty accessible. I do believe it's still a thing. Like, if you want to find it, you will get it. So I don't know. I don't know. But I'm not an expert on prison. I have no fucking idea. But yeah, why wouldn't you be tentative about this person who clearly has a history of back and forth of addiction, of neglectful parenting? But here's the thing. You said it's been a year and she's been pretty on great behavior. again, this goes back to the idea of forgiveness, of somebody being able to have a sense of what they've done wrong and a sense of taking responsibility, right? Has she taken responsibility? Does she acknowledge the horribleness of your past with her? And fuck, I might even ask her. I'd sit down with her and be like, dude, bro, like, I want this, bro. But your track record is pretty crazy. And I'm not so sure I can jump all in. I can't be all in. And I would tell her, like, hey, here's the facts of your past behavior. And can I trust you moving forward? Or see how she reacts. See if she acknowledges. See if she takes responsibility. Because generally, if, like I said in the beginning of the show, if someone doesn't take responsibility, there's no changing the behaviors. There's no moving forward. It sounds like she's on the up and up. It sounds like it. However, it sounds like she's also got a lot of stuff going on with recidivism and drug use. So yeah, you should be on guard, but you should also convey that. I would convey that to her, adult to adult. I like this. I like you. I like what we're doing, but I don't really trust you. And if she's of sound mind and if she is as healed as she kind of seems to be, I think that she'd agree with you and be like, yeah, I kind of fucked up with you guys for 29 years. Sorry about that whole leaving you to raise your own siblings, and sorry about that whole displacing you and making you live with your grandparents. Oh, and then your grandparents kicked you out last minute too. Sorry about ruining your entire childhood existence. Like, if there's no acknowledgement of that, then I would say be on red alert. Red alert. Red flags. There's flags are flapping so loud in your ears, you can't even hear what's happening around you. Yeah. And I'd say plan for the next stint in prison, the next relapse. Look, 7.5 years of sobriety is pretty amazing. And I know nothing about this kind of, really, unfortunately, drug stuff is not, I've had some experience, but not, I've not had this particular fun in my family. We tend to just go alcoholism, narcissism, mental illness, not so much the hard drugs. So sorry, I wish I had more personal experience, but my gut tells me you're right. Why trust a bitch? She hasn't exactly had a great track record, and a year of acting like a normal person. Cool. And also, hey, I look at what we think a normal person acts like, or a maternal person, BT dubs, because you've had such shitty mothering. I think those of us that have had shitty moms kind of like our bar for what's nice and motherly is really low. Really, really, really tragically, tragically low. So what you might think of as like, hey, she's really doing this, could just be as simple as like, wow, she showed up on time for dinner tonight. Isn't that a miracle? Isn't she a great mom? But you say that she's listening to you and interested in your life and stuff. And that's pretty amazing. So I don't know if she had to come to Jesus in prison. I hope she did. And it's not impossible. I mean, I've read stories, biographies of junkies, people that have been horribly addicted to drugs and have turned their lives completely around through, you know, groups, AA or whatever, therapy or whatever the fuck, Jesus. It's not impossible. There's always the potential for people to change if they're not completely kooky nutters, mentally ill and untreated or untreatable. There's a handful of disorders that are very difficult to treat and medicate and everything. But other than that, I mean, if someone's doing the work, why not? Not only that, Autumn, I want this to work for you. I want you to have a mommy. Believe me, I fucking want this to be real too. But that being said, you have every right to protect yourself, your emotions and your siblings' emotions. You got to call her out on the past, have a real, real, real open, honest dialogue about that past. and see what she fucking says. And if it's total denial, and if she says some horse shit like, I did the best I could. No, you didn't. No, you didn't, bitch. When you were in prison, was that the best you could do? Or when you were shooting shit into your arms, was that the best you could do? Don't fucking, if any parent says that to you when you confront them on their shit, that's like the laziest, bullshittiest, like, forget it. You're banging your head against the wall. I did the best I could. Or when they blame you, well, you were a bad kid. Da-da-da-da-da. You were so difficult. Oh, forget it. Forget it. You're never going to have the relationship you want. By the way, I highly recommend this book I just read. It's called Toxic Parents, that discusses this exact phenomenon. Toxic Parents by Dr. Susan Forward, old school 80s book. Now, she advocates the confrontation method with people, with the person that offended you. I'm not so sure that's always called for. I wouldn't personally advocate that, especially if that person's on another goddamn planet. It's going to be more harmful and hurtful, I think, for you than for than anything else. And, you know, sometimes it's best just to kind of throw your arms in the air and accept what is than to constantly plan your case against. You know what I'm saying? You feel me what I'm talking about? Man, God damn it. All right. Since we're on this topic, I think this is a pretty great one, too. It's kind of adjacent. This one comes from M. She prefers to remain anonymous. Longtime listener, big fan of both Dead Bro and Your Mom's House. Thank you very much. Okay. She writes, I love your perspective on family members and the pressure to consistently take their shit. Plus, this is a newish situation I am in and very unfamiliar with. A close family member of mine suffers from recently diagnosed depression and anxiety. She's taking antidepressants, but often strays from her dose, and as well, drinks heavily and posts frequently and obnoxiously while intoxicated. Of course, I know this is her way of desiring attention, something myself and my family have tried to give her, but when the posts are inappropriate and quite embarrassing, this is hard for me to respond to. She quickly backlashes times I have tried to help by treating me similar to how she did when I was 10 years old, making me feel small and that my opinions are not worthy of her time. For some quick backstory, to explain my level of sympathy, we are sisters close in age and have never had the best relationship. To be honest, she was a fucking asshole to me through my adolescence, and a lot of her defamatory words and actions stuck with me throughout that time, making me feel very alone and distant from her. She has often felt she was the black sheep of our family, but in a righteous, cocky way, insisting that since I have a stable job, spouse, and social life, that this is an easy route, in her words, that I have taken. To her, taking money from her parents and living with extended family rent-free and not showing up for her barista shifts is the more exciting and worthwhile route. At the risk of sounding like a douche, I feel her words do come from a place of jealousy, but these are choices we have both taken. We have had the exact same upbringing and opportunities in life. This kind of feuding is something I know is common with sisters, but we never really mended anything. And it's hard for me to just forgive and forget. Am I an asshole for not providing the right amount of empathy for her for what she's going through now? Deep down, I know her problems are bigger than our distance and squabbles in our past relationship. But a small part of me is clutching to feeling that I should be selfish in who I surround myself with. It is hard to push past this feeling when I see her actions and words deeply affecting my parents and family members. Sincerely and ready to get my life, M. Okay. So, M has a sister that she doesn't, I don't say how old you are, right, M? Okay, I don't know where you are in your life. And you've not really liked her. And now she's diagnosed with depression and anxiety. She's on the meds, good, but she doesn't take them. And then drinks heavily and posts horrible shit on the internet. Okay. Did I get that straight? Sounds about right. Fantastic. Wow, what a lucky scenario for you to have. What a special gift of a sibling. it's like, I get it, dude. Hey. Been there, get it, totally. So you're asking me, do I have the right amount of empathy? Should I give a shit? Should I come to her rescue? Should I participate in the rescuing up, whatever it is, the family shit that you need to, okay. The answer is no, you don't have to. You don't have to have empathy. In fact, you can be angry with her. You can be disappointed in her. You can not like her. You can choose not to have any interaction with her. You can choose to have limited interaction with her. You know, maybe the obligatory once a year holiday torture event. You don't have to feel or do a goddamn thing. Yeah. And, you know, it is that thing of like, hey, am I the a-hole here? Because I don't have the right amount of empathy for this person who's, you know, been diagnosed with stuff and is chemically imbalanced. It doesn't matter, because I think it always feels crappy on your end, right? When she acts out and doesn't take her meds and starts drinking and does her whole thing, and then you're the victim of her, it sounds like, lifelong dramas and blah, blah, blee, blah, blees. So you don't have to feel anything, firstly. And again, I think that is a cultural thing that we're supposed to, but you should have empathy. That's your sister, and you should, because she's, you know, got these mental problems, and we should all rescue. Like, no, 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 you don't have to. And in fact, it's your parents' responsibility, and it's, you know, it's let them deal with it. If you have parents that are good, you know, it's their job to wrangle, treat, corral, medicate, get help for their young. It is not your responsibility as her sister. I don't buy it. I don't believe it. I don't buy it. I think what's most important for you is to get your life, go see a shrink, go to therapy. I always advocate the therapy. Fucking talk to somebody about all this and straighten up your end of it, because your animosity towards her is more about you, right? We all know that, or maybe we don't all know that. It, you know, she's doing what she's doing, and it doesn't have to affect you in the least, but it does affect you. You're keyed up, you're fired up, you're triggered, you're wound up. You're feeling stuff about it. You're feeling animosity. You might be angry or depressed or whatever. And that's what I'm concerned with. I'm more worried about you, Em. And I'm worried about you, like, how you're going to react to what she's doing, right? Because that's all you can control is your reaction. So get your ass into therapy. Talk to a shrink. Find a sliding scale therapist. I posted a statewide sliding scale therapy list on my website. That's thebropodcast.com. Look them up. Try it out. And talk to them, because it sounds like you've had a lifelong shitty relationship with somebody that now, unfortunately, might get worse. Generally, you know, the people with the problems who don't follow the rules of protocol of treating those problems, you might be in for a lifelong fucking thing with her. So may as well get help now. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? You feel me? What I'm talking about? Okay. Okay, this one came in, and I felt so compelled to answer this person. Okay, this is from Ethan. He says, "Hi, mommy. I'm a 21-year-old with dreams of being a stand-up comedian. I have loads of material written I want to try out, but I have some psychological barriers. My wife, whom I've known since high school and have been with for 7 years now, is pregnant with our first child due May of this year. Congratulations. Neither of us have a college education and are working class people. She works for her parents' business, and I do labor for hourly pay. I personally am not afraid of the work it takes to become a working comic and juggling a newborn and day job at the same time. I know it takes years of effort, and I'm willing to go without sleep or a luxurious lifestyle in order to pursue my dream. However, I am racked with horrific guilt at the thought of pursuing my dream when I have the responsibilities of raising a child and being in a marriage. I was raised by a single father because my mother was a drug addict who hasn't been in my life since I was 10 years old. And I can't help but feel like by following my dream of being a stand-up, I'd be leading my daughter and wife into a hard life with the odds of it paying off being very low. If I don't pursue this dream, I will have to find something comfortable and passionless to do for the living like a trade. My question is, what do I go for? Something comfortable that pays so my family can have an easier life, or do I pursue my lifelong dream of being a comedian? I've been struggling with this for a while because comedy is the only thing I have any real desire to do other than provide for my growing family. Thanks, James and Ethan. Okay. First of all, what a beautifully written email. I'd say that's good. You have a good gift of language. Okay, so you're 21. You got a baby on the way. You've got a wife. You have a woman you've been with for a long time. But you have this desire to be a stand-up comedian. Great. Great. Do these things have to be mutually exclusive? No. Do you have to forgo all your dreams because you're having a family? No. So let's put things in perspective, Ethan. I don't know where you live. I don't know if it's near a comedy city, a comedy hub, if you will. But keep in mind, it takes about 10 to 15 years to even get good at stand-up. So you've got 10 or 15 years before shit's going to start really whatever happening. Actually, I would say you've got the first 6 or 7 years of just developing. And you don't need to go on the road to do that, okay? Hey, you said you've got loads of material and you want to try out. It doesn't even sound like you fucking started and you're already talking yourself out of something. You haven't even begun. Listen, it's a slow marathon stand up. And so many people take breaks, come back, have children, come back. Rodney Dangerfield didn't hit it until he was, 60 or something. He took breaks. He sold aluminum siding on houses. There's a great story of him being on The Tonight Show and the next day going to sell aluminum siding. And he goes into this guy's house and the guy goes, "Hey, weren't you on The Tonight Show last night?" And Rodney's like, "Yep." And Rodney had a family. And he, took care of his family. And when that time was up, was able to be a full-time comedian. So there are lots of people that have families. Go read a Bernie Mac's book, his autobiography about raising children and being a stand-up comedian. So firstly, let's back that ass up. You don't even know if it's something you're good at and you're already talking yourself out of it or worried about, is it worth the, should I just give up? You haven't even gotten up and tried it. You haven't even gone up and written your first 3 minutes and gone to some open mic and failed miserably. So let's see if this is something that you even have the constitution for, the wiring for, the tenacity for. It's like, you think you like something, but until you really get out there and do it, you're not going to know. So what is this going to cost in the beginning? Because everything has a cost. Like Rick Ross says, right? You got to pay the cost to be the boss. There's always a price to pay for following whatever course of action. So yeah. So here's what's going to suck in the beginning. You're working your hourly long ass day job. You have a baby. So your wife's definitely going to want you to be home in the evenings, probably. But what you're going to do is maybe once or twice a week, you're going to go after your job and you're going to go do an open mic, try to get up as early as possible. You can be home by 9. I don't fucking do a spot past 9:30 at the Comedy Store. I'm home in bed by 10:30 when I go out. There's no reason to be out until 2 in the morning if you're doing it. I'm sorry, especially if you're in a small town. If you're in a small town, there's no comedy rooms. Fucking start one. Start one. It's a great way to make cash. Start a room. Go to the local bar, the local whatever. Club, whatever, tell them, hey, give me your off night. Give me your Wednesday night. I'll do a comedy club, a comedy room in here. You invite all your friends, you invite all your people, book it, charge whatever you want to at the door. And now you've made money and you're living your dream of learning to do stand-up comedy. So there's ways to do things. It's not like there's one line, one straight line of becoming a stand-up comedian. I advise you read autobiographies of very successful comedians and see how they did it, because a lot of us don't come from ideal backgrounds, and a lot of them don't have... Listen, Phyllis Diller had 5 fucking kids and started at 35 years old. 5 children at home. But necessity made her have to get a day job as a copywriter. And her husband was a bum who didn't work, and she became the breadwinner. So listen, there's all kinds of ways to do things. There's not one linear way, and you don't have to talk yourself out of your dream simply because you don't have a perfectly clean slate. Now, what I would recommend is support your wife. You've got a year coming up where your life is about to change dramatically. And I don't know if you guys have help. I don't know if you have family around to help you with this newborn. I would ask you, for the sake of your family and the sake of your wife and your child, to spend the next, I don't know, 6 months, which is not a lot of time, just writing, getting your 3 minutes together, thinking. I wrote my Netflix special literally while I was in the throes of postpartum depression, breastfeeding my son. I was sitting in the dark at 2 a.m. and I would just have these horrible thoughts and I would write them down. And then months later, when he was kind of up and running, I would do the road and I was like, oh, this is a new chunk of material. This is going to be a thing. So out of your darkness, out of these times, you might come up with the coolest stuff. But I would recommend taking 6 months to a year to be with that baby and be with your wife and really support her and your unit, your family unit, because you won't get those months back. That's another thing too. It's a cute time. It's a good time. It's not, don't think of it as a deferral on your dreams. Think of it as an investment in that baby's life and in your life and in your wife and your marriage. So take some time to think, plan. If it's starting a comedy room in whatever small town you live in, if it's thinking about the open mic you're going to try, if it's putting together 3 minutes, your first 3 to 5 minutes of material, do that stuff. You can do that stuff when you're up at 3 a.m. with a baby. I did. Fucking sit there and write your ideas. Oh, that's funny. That's terrible. What a terrible thought that is. Oh, that could be funny. You know, you kind of have to work with life, because there's seldom ideal scenarios. We're seldom... The road is never like easy and like, hey, your schedule's cleared. Everything's perfect. You're in a good mood. You're totally healthy. You can do it. Like, it just doesn't work out. It seldom works out that way. There's always some kind of roadblock. And I say, use those things. Use the fact that you're a young parent. And you also have to live your life to be a comedian, right? You have to do the things that other people do, like having babies. So take this time to be with your family. Grow up a little, because you're going to grow up exponentially in the next year with this newborn. And you're going to have so much more material. And then when your baby is a little stable, maybe, like I said, a year, I would give it a year, honestly, until you and your wife are stabilized, everybody's kind of found a groove. I would talk to my wife in the interim, maybe once things have calmed down, and go, hey, look, I really want to explore this thing of being a comedian. I just want to explore it. Because that is what you're doing, Ethan. You don't know if you really are wired to do this yet, if you really, really want to put in the... Who knows? You might get up, do it, and go, you know what? I don't think I want to be a stand-up, but I'd like to try sketch comedy. Yeah, I think I want to do characters. Or maybe I'd like to write for television. Wouldn't that be kind of a cool idea? Or maybe I'd like to do... You know, I want to be on SNL. So I'm going to start working on my celebrity impressions. So there's so many lanes to comedy, and... I mean, heck, when I started out the Groundlings doing improv, and I thought, well, I'm gonna be on SNL. That's what I want. And like, that's the furthest thing that I ended up doing. So you're just dipping your toes in the water. So let's not put so much pressure on the career at the moment. And of course you should follow your dreams. Of course. And of course, you know, talk to your wife about it. Explain this stuff to her. I think getting her on board is going to be a lot more beneficial to you guys in the long run. And it take baby steps too. You know, you're probably not going to be a feature act in a year. It takes a while. And I know nobody wants to hear that when they start doing stand-up. I certainly didn't like hearing that. I don't know how many times I heard it takes 10 years. It takes 10 years. And you know what? That's really accurate. Actually, 10 years and then 15 to really make it. So you've got some time. And just enjoy it. Enjoy the process. Enjoy your child, your wife, and then do this thing when you have, you know, the time. Tell her I won't go out more than X times a week, because you do have obligations, which is fine. That's okay. You can have family obligations and still be a comedian. Make a promise to your wife. I'm only going to go out. I've had these open mics planned, booked, whatever. You know, Monday nights, I'm going down to the Derby or whatever the fuck the name is. Friday nights, I'm going to be at the bowling alley. I'm going to ask to go up early. I can be home by 10, you know, reassure her. And don't go out and get drunk and fuck around when you're out there doing the work. Do the fucking work, because you're a family guy. Okay, you're not going to have the luxury of being a typical open mic or douchebag comedian. So you're going to have to work a lot smarter, not harder. You're going to have to do things a little differently. You're not going to fuck around. You're not going to do drugs. You're not going to party. You're going to go out, do your work, and come home so that you keep your family intact. And that way your kid's going to have a dad, and your kid's not going to grow up the way you did, right? Being abandoned and you know, feeling like shit. So yeah, there's lots of ways around this. Start reading books about the big ones, the ones you like, the comedians you've liked. I guarantee not all of them have had straight and narrow paths to their success. There's so many different ways to be successful at stand-up. That's kind of the beauty of it, is that there's just no one way. There's no one door. There's no one, and especially with the internet. I mean, I've known comedians who put a bit on the internet and then boom, they're selling out theaters. So it's like, it's all changing and it's going to change. And there's no reason that you have to just, this is a 1950s mentality. Like, I just got to put my nose to the grindstone. I got to give up everything and be miserable. No, you don't. You're just going to take a slower path, Ethan. You're going to take a path that's more responsible. You're going to do it the right way. You're going to do it a little slower, right? And then you'll see where it goes, where it takes you. But at least try it out first. Try it out. You don't even know. We don't even know yet what you're capable of. But you don't want to spend your life being miserable. And if your wife gives you pushback, I would tell her that this is something that's going to really make me happy and really make us happy in the long run, blah, blah. And that you're going to promise her that she is your first obligation. The family is your first obligation. Always, 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 right? Reassure her that, because that's what she's going to freak out over. And she's not going to like being alone on weeknights. That's for sure. Or weekends or whenever it is. So if she has friends and family, invite them over while you're gone. That's going to help her out a lot. She may get lonely. Just like, that is one of the pitfalls, which is why I say don't go out 5 nights a week. You don't have to be a fucking lunatic. You can dip your toe into this stuff. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. Fuck, you can have an open mic in your garage, in your backyard. There are backyard shows here in LA. You can bring the show to you. Why not? All right. I hope that helps. Listen, I got to go. I got to take a piss. This is fucking killing me right now. Anyways, email me, thatsdeepbropodcast@gmail.com. Come see me do stand up, Christina P online, for tickets. And, yeah, it's been a good week, bros. Let's do this again next week. Okay. Until next time, that's been Deep Bro.
Now what? I don't know. Philosophize with.
It's Christina P, aka Miss Jeans. This ain't your mom's house. It's a different theme. Gotta be critically thinking. Like you caught up at a cocktail party, our thoughts start to sink in. John Locke, or was it Socrates? Aristotle or Plato, maybe Hippocrates. Got us talking all properly, topically. Just a comedian discussing these philosophies. Serious questions, silly people. What's that? What's that? That's deep, bro.
It is the ultimate metaphor for life, and you know what that is?
What?
That's deep, bro. That's deep, bro. That's deep, bro. That's deep, bro.